For a real estate negotiation to be considered truly successful, both the buyer and seller must be satisfied with the outcome of the negotiation, and each party must believe that they're a winner. Notice I said a winner, not the winner. Most people believe that in every negotiation someone wins and someone loses. And that's sometimes the case, but in good negotiations, nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, believing that there must be a winner and a loser can actually undermine your chance of conducting a successful negotiation. To conduct a successful negotiation, you must be clear on what you want going in. You must also be diplomatic so that you can help drive the negotiation to a place where everyone wins. Successful negotiations are often the result of the atmosphere in which the negotiation takes place. By that, I don't mean the physical environment in which the two sides negotiate, although the right environment can help put everyone at ease, but I mean the personal and psychological atmosphere. I cannot emphasize enough the role that your interpersonal skills play in the negotiation process. In particular, to create the right atmosphere, you should try very hard to do the following. Establish trust and credibility and rapport. Use the seller's name. Learn the seller's interests. And be an empathetic listener. Let me explain what I mean. Your first goal in any negotiation should be to establish trust and credibility with the other party. I once read that people are successful in life only to the degree that they're able to make people like them and trust them. And this is certainly true in negotiating. When talking to a seller, take a few minutes to establish rapport and a trustful relationship. This is so essential to negotiating. If sellers feel comfortable with you, they will often be more forthcoming with important information, such as their true needs, than they might otherwise be. If you're meeting the seller for the first time, learn the seller's name and use it over and over again in the conversation. Every person likes to hear their name said in a friendly way, and doing so makes the other party feel valued and important. Also, try to learn the seller's interests. If you're purchasing a single-family home, for example, look around the house when you visit the property. You might be able to discover some clues about the seller's interests, whether it's sports or a doll collection. Pick up on your observations and bring up these things in conversation. As you talk to the seller, remember to always be an empathetic listener. Imagine yourself in his or her situation and try to experience emotionally what the seller is experiencing. By doing so, you might gain a new perspective on the negotiation and be able to make an offer that the seller is likely to accept. Also, people like the feeling that they're being listened to, and doing this will help establish rapport. In addition to creating the right atmosphere, you must be diplomatic. Diplomacy is critical to successful negotiations. Avoid overly criticizing the property and never criticize the seller. Many people believe that by being overly critical, they can somehow force a seller into lowering the price or giving more favorable terms, and this couldn't be further from the truth. As a matter of fact, this tactic frequently backfires and only makes the seller less flexible. If you need to mention some of the property's weaknesses to the seller, do so in a nice way without being critical. You don't have to deliberately overlook the faults of a property. I mean, if the building has a flat roof, for example, you could ask, "Have you had any leakage problems with the roof? I've heard that flat roofs present some unique problems." Or if the property is on a very busy street, you might say, "The property is pretty close to the street. It's pretty noisy, isn't it?" By pointing out some of the flaws in a nice way, you let the seller know that you're aware that the property is not perfect, yet you're being careful not to offend the seller. This conditioning may help the seller understand why your eventual offer, if you decide to make an offer, is below the asking price. Likewise, don't be timid about praising those aspects of the property that make it appealing to a buyer. This can work wonders in creating a positive emotional environment. Think about your own reaction if you were the seller. Most likely you would want to work with someone who makes you feel good about yourself and your property. Someone who attacks your property might make you feel criticized and you would automatically become defensive. So negotiations reflecting this mindset are likely to fail. As with anything else in life, preparation is essential to success in any negotiation. Prepare by evaluating your own needs and those of the seller in order to develop a strategy that will result in mutual satisfaction and an agreement. I mean, whether you're purchasing a single-family home or a $6 million apartment building, your negotiations are going to center around six variables. First, price. Second, terms, that is the interest rate, amount, and length of the mortgage. Third, down payment. Fourth, the closing date. Five, the monthly payment. And six, personal property, for example, appliances to be left with a property. When you begin negotiating, you're probably going to know your wants and needs, so you'll know what you want to achieve in the negotiation. It's quite easy, however, to overlook one of your most important needs, and that is the need to know the seller's needs. The more you can learn about a seller's needs, the more effective you will be in your negotiations. All that you generally know about the seller is what he or she wants. That is, the asking price and the terms. Actually, such wants may or may not match the seller's needs, and the seller may not even be aware of that fact. When you deal primarily with flexible sellers, you must become familiar with the reasons why a seller is flexible, and this is very important. In other words, find out what has made the seller flexible. Is it loss of employment, divorce, inheritance, job transfer, management headaches, or does the basement have an incurable leak? When you ask the seller about his or her financial needs, the answers you hear will tell you the seller's wants. And usually the response is something like, "Well, I need all cash." Asking the seller how the cash will be used might be appropriate. If the seller responds by saying that the need relates to the purchase of another home, you might explain some creative financing techniques that would allow the seller to buy the home with no money down. If the seller responds with, "Well, my reasons don't matter, I just need cash," you might then say, "I'd like to give you your cash down payment, but could we spread it out over a short period of time, maybe, oh, say 48 to 60 months? The seller might even respond by saying, "Well, that's none of your business." In which case, you could respond, "I apologize for asking. I just thought by knowing the answer to that question, we might work out a way that I could buy your property so it would work out for both of us." Before walking into a negotiation, you need to develop a strategy. If you don't have one, you won't know whether or not you're progressing toward your goal of a win-win negotiation. To determine your strategy, you need to establish your goals, your BATNA, and your walkaway position. You also need to decide what you might use as non-essential contingencies to barter in the course of the negotiation. Let me talk about each one of these one at a time. If you ever take a course in negotiation, and by the way, you might add that to the list of continuing education courses you'll want to take, but if you ever take a course in negotiation, you'll hear about the importance of BATNA. BATNA stands for the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. Basically, it means what you'll do if the negotiation fails. Determine your BATNA before going into a negotiation can give you a pretty good idea of how flexible you can afford to be. Your walkaway position is your bottom line. If the seller asks for too much, or at least more than you're willing to offer, and is unresponsive to any reasonable alternatives that you suggest, you'll need to get up from the negotiation table and walk away, regardless of how much time you spent researching the property and putting together the deal. If you don't establish, at least to yourself, your walkaway position before you go into the negotiation, you might give in on points and regret it later. Be sure to remember, when you do walk away, don't burn your bridges. Compromise is what negotiations are all about. If you enter negotiations with an open mind, the seller is also more likely to have an open mind, and this mindset allows both of you to create a win-win situation. During negotiations, both parties must give something to get something. Therefore, good negotiators always use non-essential but purposeful contingencies as negotiating tools. In other words, when you use a non-essential contingency, you ask for concessions that you really don't necessarily need or even want, concessions that you're willing to negotiate away, in effect. In return, the seller concedes on a point that is important for you. For example, you might use one or more of the following non-essential contingencies. The mortgage is to be amortized over 40 years instead of 30 years. The seller is to pay all closing costs instead of just part of the closing costs. The seller warrants all appliances for a period of 1 year following the closing. The seller will repaint the interior and or exterior of the property. Or the seller is to leave one or more pieces of furniture and or window treatments. I'll never forget a union negotiation in Chicago where the union asked the company for additional pay during their vacation. I mean, after all, when the truckers were on vacation, they spent a lot more than they did when they were working. This was, at the time, a non-essential contingency. The union was very prepared to barter away that contingency in favor of receiving a concession from the company. But as it turned out, the company acquiesced on that point and actually gave the union more money during the trucker's vacation. You see, by using non-essential contingencies, you'll arm yourself with effective negotiating tactics. You might only want the seller to pay all the closing costs, for example, but by adding other contingencies, you have some extra items that you can give up to get the one that you truly want. When it comes to actually conducting the negotiation, you'll need to reaffirm your trust and credibility with the seller. You'll also want to make sure that you and the seller have the same knowledge and understanding about the property you're negotiating for, in which case you might have to educate the seller. From time to time, you'll meet a seller who has some misunderstandings about how real estate deals work. It might be that the seller's knowledge or presumed knowledge is incorrect. If you argue or disagree with the seller, it doesn't matter who's right or wrong. You're going to lose in the negotiating process. If you appear to insult the seller's intelligence, you're going to create a negative negotiating environment. If you must educate the seller, be tactful. One of the best ways to do this is by telling third-party stories. For example, if the seller says something like, "Well, the house down the street sold for $150,000. Mine is a lot nicer than that one." And you have already researched the neighborhood and you know that the other house did not sell for $150,000, you might say this, "Well, Bob, I thought the other house sold for that amount too, but when I was talking to a broker the other day, I found out that the house only brought $135,000. You relieve tension when you explain or educate using third-party stories, and the seller does not feel that you're trying to cram something down his throat.